Has Donald Trump been banned from addressing Britain's Parliament?
This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack. Welcome to the programme. More than 150 members of Parliament have signed a symbolic motion calling for President Trump not to be given the honour of speaking in Westminster Hall when he arrives later this year on a state visit. Here's what the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, had to say in the House of Commons.
An address by a foreign leader to both houses of Parliament is not an automatic right, it is an earned honour. Moreover, there are many precedents for state visits to take place to our country which do not include an address to both houses of Parliament. That's the first point. The second point is, in relation to Westminster Hall, there are three key holders to Westminster Hall: the Speaker of the House of Commons, the Speaker of the House of Lords, and the Lord Great Chamberlain. Ordinarily, we are able to work by consensus, and the hall would be used for a purpose, such as an address or another purpose, by agreement of the three key holders. I must say to the Honourable Gentleman, to all who signed his early day motion, and to others with strong views about this matter on either side of the argument, that before the imposition of the migrant ban, I would myself have been strongly opposed to an address by President Trump in Westminster Hall. After the imposition of the migrant ban by President Trump, I am even more strongly opposed to an address by President Trump in Westminster Hall. So far as the Royal Gallery is concerned, and again, I operate on advice, I do not perhaps have as strong a say in that matter. It is in a different part of the building, although customarily an invitation to a visiting leader to deliver an address there would be issued in the names of the two speakers. I would not wish to issue an invitation to President Trump to speak in the Royal Gallery. And I conclude by saying to the Honourable Gentleman this. We value our relationship with the United States. If a state visit takes place, that is way beyond and above the pay grade of the Speaker. However, as far as this place is concerned, I feel very strongly that our opposition to racism and to sexism and our support for equality before the law and an independent judiciary are hugely important considerations in the House of Commons.
That's the Speaker of the House, John Bercow. The thing is, inviting the President for an official state visit but then banning him from addressing Parliament is just silly. John Bercow had no problem having other world leaders address Parliament, including the Chinese President, even though MPs were unhappy about his policy on Tibet and China's record on human rights. And Bercow sucked up to the Emir of Kuwait when he came here and addressed Parliament, and Kuwait discriminates against women and has no laws prohibiting domestic violence, sexual harassment, or marital rape. Having Donald Trump come here but not be allowed to speak in case he says something you disagree with is just wrong. If someone holds extreme views, we shouldn't be gagging them. We should let them speak so everybody knows what those views are and can make their own mind up. Let's cross to Philadelphia now via Skype and check in with long-time London Calling listener Jim McCabe. You all right, Jim?
Not bad. Yourself?
Yes, except Liverpool got beat again.
No.
By your lowly Hull. Away. 2-0.
Oh, what's happening in the world?
It's beyond a joke. Yeah, what is happening in the world? Britain is leaving the EU, Donald Trump is president, and Liverpool haven't won for weeks. Watch yourself.
And the bloody Patriots won.
Yeah. The cheats, the deflators.
Yeah. And it was what an awful game.
Was it?
At half time it was 28-3. The Falcons were up. The Atlanta was up.
Yeah.
And in the first half, the commentators made the, at one point they'd gone up 14-0.
Yeah.
Something. And they said, oh, in the Super Bowl, no one's ever come, from a 14-point deficit. Someone's come back to win from down 10 points three times.
You see,
but
that,
no one's come back from more than 10 points ever.
That is bad commentary. Because if you're a broadcaster, you have one job, and that is to keep people listening or watching, because the ratings depend on it. So even if a team is getting battered, you never say, you know what? I'm going to call this now. There's no point. You might as well just go to bed. You know, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen now. You might as well switch over and watch a movie or something, because nothing's going to change here.
Almost, yes.
They should be going, look, no one's ever done this, but I really fancy them to do it. This team can do it. I think this team can do it. This ball game is not over yet. That's what you should be doing.
But there's a lot of football. It was quite early in the game.
Really? Well, they should never even at to get that last second of rating on the last few minutes, they should be actually, you know, keeping you there, because you'll switch it off if you think it's finished.
But then again, yeah, and in the, somebody must have said to Atlanta at halftime, oh, by the way, you guys have to play a second half. Did you know that? Oh no, we didn't, because they didn't play at all. 25 unanswered points.
Wow.
For the Patriots in the second half.
Did the Patriots maybe work them out? Because that happens in soccer a lot. You know, a team will come out and they're all over them. And the second half, it's a totally different game. It's a game of two halves. And what happens is that tactically, the managers and the coaches on the losing side have worked out what is the key to unlocking them. And they change the whole setup and away they go. Was it something like that? Did they work them out? Did they work out the defense?
I don't know enough about football
right.
to see if, or, but knowing the Patriots coach, well, oh yes, we've hacked their system, and so here's their entire playbook, so we know exactly what they're calling.
Right.
Each,
yes.
You know.
Yeah. And by the way, I've taken a few PSI out of the ball. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. You know, it's just. Tom Brady, the quarterback, he did have a 4-game suspension at the beginning of the season. The first 4 games he wasn't allowed to play.
Was that for the deflating the ball?
That was for the deflating thing, yes.
Right.
But it's just okay. So what did he do this game to cheat? What did the coach do this game to cheat?
And I just don't like the name the Patriots. It suggests that unless you support that team, then you don't support Patriots, which is not true.
Yeah, their rivals should be the anarchists.
Yes. Yeah.
It should have been the New England Patriots against the Atlanta anarchists.
Or the traitors. The Patriots versus the traitors. That would be, as an NFL team, I bet no one's got the traitors.
No.
You know, a lot of them are animals, aren't they? Obviously, with the Falcons, and you got the Eagles.
Yes, there's a lion somewhere.
You see, I get the Seahawk, I get the Falcon, I get the lion. I really don't get the dolphin. You know, a dolphin. It's not an aggressive animal, isn't it? It's a friendly animal.
Yeah.
You know, that'd be like having a team called the Cuddly Bunnies.
Ferrets.
I bet the Dolphins haven't won anything for ages. There's just no fighting in that. There's no fight in that name. And I'm sure Dolphins are quite aggressive because they're carnivores, aren't they? And they hunt and all the rest of it, but they're not known for it. That's not what they're known for. You know, it's not like the Sharks. There was a rugby league team in Australia called Cronulla. They're the Sharks. I get that. But the Dolphins? Anyway, and the Patriots is a bad name.
The Copenhagen Cockroaches, they're never going away. You cannot defeat them.
That's right. Yeah. They're going to be there when everyone else has given up. They're still going to be, they're going to survive. Yeah.
No, they're going to be there.
Yeah. Now that's a name. The Patriots. Are you patriotic? Yes. Do you support the Patriots? No. Well, then you're not. No. That's not fair. That's putting it on someone. I don't like that. Don't like that. And what's their logo then, the Patriots? Because I get the Falcons. It can be a falcon, a raptor. Well, Patriots, what do they have?
I think they're...
bloke in a three-cornered hat?
Something. I think they're a mascot.
Yes.
They do have a guy running around with a flintlock.
Oh, really?
On the sideline, yes.
I don't know. I don't like the name. Do they mean patriotic to the United States or just New England?
I'm guessing it's just from the Revolution. You know, okay, New England. I think it's the only team that has a regional name. Everything else is a city.
It seems unfair. I mean, you can't have like, if it was USA versus Atlanta, you'd think that's unfair. Well, New England versus Atlanta, that's not even either, is it?
Yeah.
What's that all about? The New England Patriots?
Well, it's the region. It's
Massachusetts,
Maine, Connecticut. They're based. Their stadium is in Connecticut,
right?
New England, New Hampshire, probably.
Yeah, that's New England. That's it's an entire northeast of the United States. Well, it's clearly not even close to fair as far as representation goes. So they were cheats going into it. Forget Deflategate. They're already cheating by roping in more of a catchment area than anybody else. Quite greedy, really. They couldn't be the Connecticut Patriots? Oh, that sounds terrible.
Sound terrible.
Doesn't it? The Connecticut Patriots. I mean, that sounds like one of those teams that the Harlem Globetrotters play. Wow.
I think there's only, what is the name of the team that the Harlem Globetrotters always play? That'd be a good trivia question.
Is it always the same team?
Yes.
Is it something like the Wizards or something, isn't it?
I think it's the Washington.
Actually, no, there are Wizards, aren't there? Wizards is a real team.
There is a Wizard somewhere. I want to say it's a made up team. It's a fake. It's not a real team.
Yeah,
but the name is, I think, it's the Washington. And I don't want to say it might be the Washington Senators or the Washington. It's the Washington something or other. At least it was.
It's always Washington, is it? They're playing
the Washington Generals.
The Washington Generals.
From 1953 until 1995.
Oh, it was the Washington Generals.
The Generals played exhibitions against the Globetrotters.
Right, and the score was probably 0-500 or something.
Yeah, they never losing more than 13,000 games.
Right, and have they changed the team they play now?
And then eventually disbanded disbanded the Generals in 1995, forming a new team,
yes,
the New York Nationals.
Oh,
which has
right.
also achieved an impressive losing streak. This is according to Wikipedia.
Right. Right. So they don't need to call anybody the Connecticut Patriots. There's no need for that. No. I mean, deflating the ball, I think the Patriots got that idea from the Harlem Globetrotters, didn't they? Isn't that one of their moves? That's one of their moves. I'm pretty sure it is. I'm pretty sure I've seen that. Where they take all the air out the ball. That's where they got the idea from.
Next, they'll be running out with a bale, with a with a bucket that you'd presume is full of ice water, but it's really confetti.
Yes. Yeah. You presume it's full of Gatorade. And
yeah.
And they want to
It's just confetti.
And it's just confetti. Yeah. And actually, isn't that a kind of a Harlem Globetrotters thing as well, to be behind and then to come back? I put it to you. The Super Bowl was rigged.
I sort of thought that in watching the second half, just because it was such a different game. It was just sort of Atlanta just said, the coach of Atlanta said, okay, wait a minute. We've really run the score up here. We're supposed to lose this. All right, go out there and just be awful.
Yeah. And going into it, here's why it was. Here's more circumstantial evidence that proves the Super Bowl was rigged. Going into it, the Patriots were the favorites, right?
I'd assume so, because it was their... I think it's... This was Tom Brady's fifth Super Bowl win.
Right. So on paper, the Patriots had it going in.
Yeah.
So the odds you'd get from any bookie would be so slim. It wouldn't be worth backing them. But let's look at this. What if they were a long way behind at half time, so far behind no one had come back from that far behind? The odds a bookie would give you on a Patriots win at half time would be reasonable. They'd be good value
odds.
Yeah,
good point.
So that's what happened. Some betting syndicate has said, we're going to make a lot of money on the Super Bowl. The Patriots are going to win it. But what we're going to do is we're going to get the Patriots to just, like, we're going to get them to slack off for the first half. And then when the odds go up and they start giving us some good value, then we'll lay the money on. Once we've got the money on, we'll give you the word. Second half, you can come out and batter the Falcons. That's what's gone on. It's just too fishy. And this is a team, they have a track record of cheating. So that's what's gone on there.
I just don't trust any of it.
Right. Okay. I see. It's all just too suspicious. Yeah.
You know, once you've cheated, and you don't start cheating in the NFL.
You're either honest or you're not.
Yeah.
In anything. You're either honest or you're not.
No, no one at 45 says, you know what? I've never robbed a bank.
That's right. But it's at times like this, you realize how wonderful it is to live in a free country. Because here I am, thousands of miles from you, on the other side of the Atlantic, with no idea whatsoever how the game of American football is played, or even how it is scored. And I have decided, based on absolutely nothing, that the game was rigged.
Yes.
I love being free to say stuff like that.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, free will. Thanks, independent thought.
Yeah. Thanks, free speech. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm saying the game was rigged and I know nothing. Because a lot of free speech, what it allows you to do is talk out of your ass. That should have been what should have been in the Constitution.
It's an addendum to the Constitution.
Oh, is it?
Called the Bill of Rights.
It's in the Bill of Rights. Free speech is in the Bill of Rights.
The first 10 amendments to the Constitution, there's 27?
Mm-hmm.
It's the first 10 are called the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
And free speech is one of the five freedoms enumerated in the First Amendment.
And although it's written in a more impressive form, it's basically the freedom to talk out of your ass on any topic you desire.
Yes, that's translated into 21st century. Feel free to talk out your ass. Okay.
Yes. And if it wasn't for that, Donald Trump would not be president. Here's a genuine hero. 42-year-old Rob Smith is the first British man since Ernest Shackleton 100 years ago to complete a new route to the South Pole. We followed his progress via satellite phone on London Calling. And Rob, it's a pleasure to finally meet you in person.
Oh, a pleasure to meet you too.
Can I have a look at your ear?
There you go.
Oh, right. How much of your ear did you lose in the Antarctic?
Probably about a centimetre off the bottom.
Right, so that was just through the cold?
Yes, when you get the cold of about minus 30 with a little bit of wind builds up, you start then building up to gales, you can get minus 90 wind chill factor. And if that touches your skin, you lose it, unfortunately.
So how was your ear exposed?
I had a hat on that had ear flaps, and you tie it underneath your chin. And I think I'd been for lunch and undone the cord, and then the flap in the afternoon was just flapping open a little. So it was my stupidity, actually. You never like, as an explorer, to get anything like frostbite, because it does show that you actually haven't been paying attention for something. We like to be safe.
It's not a badge of honour, then? It's not like that scene from Jaws where they're showing each other the scars? It's like, I got that on Everest, or lost that toe on the Eiger.
Do you know, that's what my friends are saying. So, in fact, I've never worn any earrings, so who needs an earlobe, eh?
Exactly. All right. Let's go back to the beginning. You're from Harpenden.
Absolutely, yes.
What do you do for a living?
I work for a technology company in London, and I look after a part of their sales operation.
Right, so very different to being an Antarctic explorer.
Oh, so different, and coming back to it is even more different.
Is it? So you're back at work now.
Yes,
how long have you been back?
Just 2 days.
Quite an adjustment, then.
It's a very big adjustment, yes.
The good thing, though, if you get annoyed with someone, you can now slam a door, because I'm guessing if you got annoyed with one of the other guys on the expedition, slamming the flap of the tent, not as effective.
Has no effect at all.
Yeah. Okay, so how did you get from that, from an office job, not a physical job, I'm guessing?
No, a bit of walking around the city, but other than that, not really, no.
How did you go from that to going on this new route to the Antarctic?
So the quick part of the story is 4 years ago, unfortunately, my best friend died of cancer. He was just given 3 weeks to live from finding out, so it was a real shock. A month after that, my mother gave up her fight against cancer and died. And the month after that, I got diagnosed. You know, we'd lived with my mother having this for 25 years, so nothing personally, but obviously personal to me through my mother and what she went through.
Yeah.
So effectively, when all that happened, I went through my own treatments. A year later, I got it back again, so I had to have
chemotherapy. And what kind did you have?
I had testicular cancer.
Right.
So it's really all a game of statistics. If you have the operation and the chemotherapy, or just the operation. So anyway, I decided to take it through the route of leaving the chemo, but unfortunately the cells built up again. So anyway, I'm completely fine now, totally in remission. But what that really made me do was just look at how I'd been living my life, look at what I'd been doing, and I just wanted to prove to myself and to other people that cancer doesn't actually mean the end. In fact, it can mean the beginning. So I looked for something incredible to do, because when you look at people that are trying to raise money, and I wanted to raise money for Cancer Research UK, they're doing more and more incredible things, you know, rowing the Atlantic or something like that, in order to get the publicity that you need to really move that forward. So I started looking. I found a guy called Eric Phillips, who's a famous explorer. He's done more than 6,000 kilometres in the South Pole. So he's a true legend. And he said that he was planning something special with a guy called Keith Tuffley. So anyway, I met the two. We started talking about it, and it was skiing a new route to the South Pole. So when we started talking about it, we realised that if I did it, because they're two Aussies, I would become the first British explorer to ski a new route to the pole.
Wow.
So once I'd heard that, that was it. That was the only thing I was ever going to do. Yeah.
And you got on okay with them? Because they're strangers at first, and you're going to get pretty intimate.
Yeah, I can speak a little Australian.
Okay, yeah. Have a good weekend.
Yeah.
Well, I lived in Australia for 6.5 years and actually became a citizen, so I know the Aussie culture quite well.
The weirdest one was they kept saying, because you had some boiled sweets, which they call all lollies. Sweets lollies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they call, we only call them lollies if they're on a stick.
Yes.
But in Australia, any sweet is a lolly, and they'll have a kid's lolly scramble at like a school fete or something where they'll just chuck a load of sweets out. But everything becomes lollies. I was an air conditioning engineer, and so we'd be going into different places, and I'd be going in with apprentices and stuff. And there was an exhaust fan not working in an RSL club. They're like a British Legion club.
Yeah.
There was an exhaust fan not working, so we had to go in and fix it. And of course, because it was a toilet, it stunk in the gents. And the apprentice says to me, "Yeah, the bloke's dealing with it by putting in a load more trough lollies." And so the urinal cakes or whatever you call them, they were lollies as well, trough lollies.
Yeah.
And then the funniest one I heard was I was in a supermarket and there was a bloke buying cigarettes. And he says, "Hello, love, I've just come in for some lung lollies." So, yeah, the Australians, it's slightly different, isn't it? It's slightly different. But they're good fun and they're grafters. They're hard workers.
Absolutely. And the two of them are absolutely legend skiers. So, you know, I learned a lot from them and it made my journey a lot easier by learning some of the things that they could teach me as far as skiing. So obviously, Eric is an explorer,
mm-hmm.
And Keith is a pretty much an all-star cross-country skier. So,
and your background in skiing then, as a comparison?
A couple of week holidays, you know, over the years with my family, but all downhill. So never did that before. The only previous skiing to the South Pole was obviously the training we did in the North Pole. So last April, ironically, to train for the South Pole, we did 160 kilometers skiing to the North Pole.
Right.
So that was the first time.
So that was the three of you as a team?
So no, Keith and I were on a team of five.
Yeah.
And Eric was leading another team. In fact, he was leading the youngest ever girl to ski to the pole.
Wow.
A lady called Jade. And she's an incredible young lady, really is. And she's actually going to ski part of the route that we did next year.
How old is she?
She'll be 16 by then.
Wow.
But, yeah.
Wow. And Prince Harry was involved in one of those, wasn't
he? Yes. So Eric, as I say, he's a real legend. So when the Walking Wounded expedition set off the race...
Is it all wounded soldiers?
And, yes, well, it was, yeah.
Not just soldiers. But
so they had a US team, a UK team, and a Commonwealth team.
Yeah.
And Eric led the Commonwealth team.
Yeah.
So
you were very much the rookie in this group.
Oh, massively so, yes.
Right. So what did you learn on the North Pole trek in your preparation that surprised you the most about this kind of adventure?
I think the North Pole was all about cold weather training. And you know, you can talk about cold weather training, but you really have to experience it. You know, in the North Pole, it's a lot colder on average. It's brutal in the fact that the sun doesn't touch you, so there's no heat from the sun. Whereas in the South Pole, if you're in the tent and you've got the sun out, you're actually quite warm in the tent. So very different in that purpose. I think the other thing was really learning about the ice. And what a massive effect global warming is really having on the ice. You know, there are water leads, which are big open inlets of water, right up to the North Pole itself. So if you think about a piece of ice that's floating, which is the frozen Arctic Ocean, it's the size of Europe, and it's retreating all the time, and year on year it's getting smaller. And, you know, people used to be able to ski from Russia over to Canada to the pole.
Wow.
And it just can't do it anymore. So I think it's a real shame. If you read about some of the environmental issues with the polar bears as well.
Yeah.
You know, lots of polar bears are dying now because they can't manage the length of swim from the land to the ice. So it's a really sad state of affairs.
So another good reason why maybe Donald Trump should go to the North Pole. It'd be great if he went and didn't come back. But but you know, because he doesn't believe in England. I think he tweeted that it was a conspiracy set up by the Chinese.
Well, I can fundamentally and categorically state that that is not the case.
You've got first-hand experience.
I certainly have. And even when we were in the South Pole, I mean, there was a story about one of the ice shelves broke off. And you're talking about huge, huge pieces of ice that are breaking off. You know, the Ross ice shelf where we started is the size of France. And it's 250 meters thick. So, you know, you think these things, they start retreating, breaking off, and then they go into the ocean and start and then melt. It's really affecting, it's going to affect. And I think, you know, I know we're doing lots of things where we've got people signing up for the new accords, but, you know, there's things that are already set in motion that, we really got to look after the Antarctic. It has 70% of the world's fresh water, 90% of the world's ice. If we don't look after that place, it's really going to cause us problems, and not for us maybe, but for our children and their kids as well.
So you do the prep at the North Pole. After that, did you have any hesitation?
No, I think after completing the North Pole, getting to the pole itself was such an amazing experience, and it is a beautiful, beautiful environment. You have, you know, different types of ice, and you have pressure ridges that cause, you know, 10, 15 meter high pieces of ice that, you know, just like boulders of ice. Where you have the, like, plates of the ice hit each other and create these ridges. You get over those, and you can have multiple ones of those in a row that will take you all day to get over. Just getting to the pole was just a really incredible experience.
And you walk all the way, or you ski all the way.
All the way, yes.
But that you're not being towed by dogs
by
sleds
or
anything.
No. Just skiing with your sled behind you. Keith and I had a bit more weight than the other guys when we went to the North Pole, because we were training for the South. So we had 70 kilos in the North, which you could probably get away with 50. And then for the South Pole, we had probably just under 100 kilos.
Yeah. Now, I weigh about 65 kilos, so yeah, that's a lot to drag around.
Well, I'm going to start doing some talks about two things, you know, the South Pole itself and what it really means to the environment, and also about some motivation to the children of different schools, talking about how they actually need to draw on their, you know, their inner strength to complete things. And one of the things I'm going to do is I brought my sled back with me. So if I've worked it out, if you get 3 11-year-olds,
right,
that's about 100 kilos.
That's so. About 100.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that is... When I lived in Australia, just getting back to the guys from Australia, it's funny. They had a saying there that to get on in Australia, what you got to do is you got to bite off more than you can chew, and then chew like baggery. and that sounds like there's
just about right, yes.
That's what you did. That's what you did. So in the South Pole, why had no one done this route that you did before? Why? What made it so different and so special?
So, you know, the story really is, you know, the route to the South Pole started with Amundsen.
Yeah, and he did it with dogs, didn't he, famously?
He did, yes, he did it with dogs. But they skied, you know, and these were the old heroes of old. They are incredible. Setting foot on something like the Antarctic when you had no maps, you had no idea of the weather, you had no idea of conditions or the cold. You know, I've just read a lot
and
about
no
those.
And no modern materials, all like canvas and leather. And,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And so we are very lucky nowadays. But Amundsen and Scott were racing. Amundsen did a new route. Obviously, he's a Norwegian. Scott actually followed a previous route that Shackleton tried. But Shackleton got within, I think it was 97 miles of the pole, but had to turn back. So Scott actually didn't pioneer a new route. He followed Shackleton's. And since then, there's been no other British explorer that has actually gone through a new route. They followed previous routes.
Right.
So that's the first piece. But why nobody's gone up the Reedy Glacier is, you know, there are a number of large glaciers. So we're talking about something that's 200 miles long and about 20 miles wide in places. So it's a huge glacier.
So this is ice. This is moving.
This is moving ice.
There's a difference between the South Pole and the North Pole. There is actual land at the
absolutely
South Pole. But this is on the ice, on the glacier.
On the glacier. It moves at around 200 meters per year. So, Yeah, it's an incredible environment. But the transantarctic mountains that basically go up through the spine that separates East and West Antarctic, there's been some of those routes have been done, the Axel Heidberg, the Shackleton, the Beardmore, etc. They've all been done, but nobody had ever set foot on the Reedy. So you'd had a few scientists.
For a reason?
Just because it's hugely crevassed at the top, so probably puts people off to start with. But, you know, you'd had some scientists that had been at the foot of the glacier just to take some samples, etc., but nobody had ever traversed. So, you know, there's still some places in the world that people haven't yet been to. So we took full advantage of that and decided to ski through it.
And you were seeing things that no human had ever seen before.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, the only thing that had happened is there'd been a few from the 60s flybys with old black and white pictures taken of some of the area, but nobody had ever been down and seen the mountains. Nobody's ever climbed those mountains. It's just a totally unspoilt piece of the world.
So you get there by ship or by plane?
So what you do is we flew to Punta Arenas, which is in the south of Chile. Mm-hmm. And then from Punta Arenas, you fly over to Union Glacier Camp. There's an organization called ALE, Antarctic Logistics and Expeditions, and they basically charter the planes that get you around. So once you fly into Union Glacier, you then have to charter another plane, a twin otter, so a twin prop plane with skis on. That takes you another 5.5 hours flight down to the bottom where the Ross Ice Shelf is to drop us off on the Ross Ice Shelf. And the key thing about claiming a new route to the South Pole is you've got to start from the continental coastline.
I see. If you don't do that, it doesn't count.
No, it doesn't, no.
Right, so, from the so you've got to go from the coast to the pole.
Correct.
For it to be official.
Correct.
Okay, so then you set off. That's it. You wave goodbye to the plane and you're on your own?
The plane goes off and you literally are probably as far away from any human being as anyone else on the planet. So then you just start skiing. So it took us about 4.5 days to actually ski even to the start of the glacier.
Yeah.
And then about 7 days through the glacier to the top. So we rise from 250 meters up to 3,000 meters. The top of the...
You're skiing uphill.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes when you've got, sastrugi is a Russian name for waves in the snow, and it's caused by the wind coming through. So katabatic winds are basically caused along glaciers, mm-hmm. where they just come and drop down from the mountains and then come across. And that can create sastrugi that, are quite high in places, and at the top of the glacier, that's where they were. But mostly through the glacier itself is just blue ice fields.
Blue ice,
yes. It's just beautiful to watch. You've got the mountains with some cloud rolling over the top of the mountains, but in front of them is just this perfect blue ice that is formed. It's just breathtaking.
And you navigate by compass or the stars? Or
cause yeah, actually, the sun, because it's 100%,
really?
It's 24-hour sunlight,
right?
During the summer months. So you basically, yes, you have a compass. You check where your shadow is, and you just follow the clock on your shadow. What we did is you can also set, because you're so close to the center, the South Pole, you can actually set your time zone. So what we did was set a time zone for Anchorage, which is 9 hours before the UK time.
Yeah.
Because that meant the sun was behind us.
Okay.
So it's much easier to ski.
So take me through a typical day.
I wake up at 6 o'clock, get the stove burning so that we can melt some ice for water, have breakfast, get all your kit ready and prepped.
And you have to take all your food with you. You can't live off the land.
Absolutely.
And you have to take all your waste away. So it's all canned and dried food.
So dried food, yes. So all,
because that'd have the lower weight, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely. Before we went, we set out all of our food sort of in packs, and then we you know, hot pressed them. So we just had a bag of food for a day.
So it's like astronaut food.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exactly the same. Yes.
Yeah, because you want low weight.
Yes.
And you'd want high carbohydrate, wouldn't you? So maybe.
Yeah, lots of calories in this. So you're talking about 7,000 calories. And if anyone can try and eat 7,000 calories, it's tough.
Yeah.
But you're expelling more than that. So, in a typical day, you're 8.5 hours of skiing.
Wow.
After breakfast, after, getting the water that you need. So, 3 liters of water is probably, what you minimum you need, for drinking. Then you have some other.
And how
water.
Do you stop that freezing?
You make sure it's boiling, and put it into your, thermos flask, and also into some bottles that you have like, thermos wraps around.
Right.
So just to make sure. I mean, it does by the end of the day, if it's not in the thermos, it's frozen. So,
yeah.
But, so then we get out the tent, and look at the weather. And depending on whether there's good visibility, and the key things are good visibility, which is based on the cloud and the wind and snow, the temperature and the wind itself, and effectively depends on what you put to cover your face. You pretty much on the plateau, so at the top you would cover your face fully every day, but going through the glacier, sometimes it was so warm, I would just have a thermal vest on.
And that's because you're working out.
Absolutely, yes. So even though, you down on the glacier side, you'd have temperatures that were probably less than minus 10.
Okay. So warmer than a domestic freezer.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
So that would sort of dictate what you wore, and then the day would start with 2.5 hour ski. Then we'd have a 10-minute break, followed by a 2-hour ski, and then 30 minutes for lunch. But if it was really cold, that 30 minutes was reduced much.
Right, let's just get on with
it. You just don't want to stuff around. You just need to keep moving.
Yeah.
Then another 2 hours, 10-minute break, and then a final 2-hour session, and then get the tent out and start the process of getting the stove on and melting ice again, which can take you probably 4 hours of the day.
Yeah. Now, and the key is to not have anything exposed to the wind, like your ear, for instance.
Absolutely.
We spoke about how quick you learn to pee.
Yes.
When we were very, talking very to you live from the Antarctic.
You turn away from the wind and hope for the best, yes.
So what was the biggest challenge then?
I think, in hindsight, I think the biggest challenge is the mental challenge. So you've always got on your mind, and you've got to keep it in the top of your mind about showing any skin. You've got to keep moving. You've got to focus on the snow that you're trying to ski, because breaking a ski or breaking a leg would be, very bad news. So it's really just making, for 37 days being totally switched on, and you can't rest. So, mental exhaustion is probably the biggest one, the biggest issue. And obviously mental exhaustion is not the greatest thing when you're trying to keep focused.
No. And getting on with the other guys, that went okay?
Oh, they were incredible. Yeah. The three of us got on really well. And to be honest with you, it was a laugh a second once we were all together.
Why? What were the funny moments then?
I just think
the in jokes.
Yeah, just the in jokes, which cannot repeat on air.
Okay. Three blokes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So then I spoke to you, I think it was about a week before you got to the pole. Was the last time I talked to you via satellite phone. Yeah. You really had a dream run then, as good as could be under the circumstances.
Yeah, we did. And, I had my issues with I had an injured heel from the first day.
That's right.
The first week and a half, really. But after that, I got stronger and stronger. Eric had a day or a couple of days where he was getting really quite bad with altitude sickness, because skiing at 3,000 meters, it's not like going higher on a mountain. You're actually skiing continuously for 20-30 days,
and you didn't take any oxygen.
No. So it just gives you, your lungs can start filling up, and that's the problem. So we had to have a rest day for Eric. It just goes to show that can affect anyone, because he's a superstar.
Yeah.
And Keith got snow blindness.
Wow.
Which is basically an effect of the wind just hitting into your eye.
Yeah.
But he got over that in the same day, which was great. But no, we got stronger and stronger, and we were very lucky with weather. We only had one day where we had blizzard conditions and we couldn't move. We had a few other days where visibility was poor, but we really wanted to keep going and just keep knocking out the 22 kilometer days.
Yeah.
And if you do that, we got there with about 5 or 6 days to spare, actually.
Wow. So then you get to the South Pole. What's there?
So it's a bit of a shock, because the first thing that you ski along is about 5 kilometers of runway.
Runway?
Yes, there's a big US camp.
Okay.
It's got about 47 people now.
And is this scientists or military?
Well, a bit of both.
Okay.
So
it's government stuff.
It's government stuff, yes.
So you're probably not allowed to get too close, are you?
No, you're not. They were really kind, though. They gave us a tour of their facility, which is huge. I mean, it's about 3-4 stories high on big pillars, which they have to... it's only got a short lifespan, though, because the ice moves slightly and builds up as well. So it's already at the first level
Okay.
on these pillars. But... yeah, and there's lots of incredible scientific buildings as well. So a couple of observatories. There's also the ice cube experiment, where they were looking for some particles that flow through the universe, and they can only capture in this very, very clear ice that they've drilled down about 2 kilometers. So, that was incredible. But yeah, there's, it's amazing.
So how many people live there, live and work there?
So 47 people live there.
Permanently.
And I'm not sure if they all stay for the winter.
Yeah.
Because the winter's really brutal there. Yeah, I think they're pretty much full time.
But they're not allowed to invite you into the canteen and give you a decent cooked meal?
No, unfortunately not.
Well,
the great thing is, I mentioned ALE. The logistics company, they also have a smaller camp.
Okay.
About a kilometer away from the pole.
Yeah.
So we just skied back to that, and they've got a nice warm tent, a big tent, with a fireplace in it.
Oh, so, okay.
And they cook food. So once we got there, it was bliss. The first thing I had, though, was I saw an orange on the bench.
Fresh fruit.
The orange. Yes.
Wow. Wow.
We'd only had dried fruit before then.
Wow. And you take the official photo?
Yes.
Where at? Where is there a place that they've set aside that's photogenic?
So there's two poles.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, there's, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen on the internet, you see a striped red and white pole with a big glass ball on the top.
Right.
Well, that's what everyone takes the pictures of. But actually, about 50 meters away, there's a metal pole that you can actually take out of the ice. That's the geographic.
Okay.
Center, so it moves slightly, that's why.
Yeah.
And they put that every year, they plant the metal pole.
And did you do a walk around the world?
Yes. So
you'd have to do that, wouldn't you? You'd have to walk around the pole and say, I've just walked around the world.
Yeah, Keith and I have done this twice now. So we did it at the North Pole.
Yes.
We measured a second in distance out.
Yeah.
And then we ran round. We had a race between the five of us, which was good fun.
Around the world race?
Yes. covering all time zones.
Yes.
So Keith and I then, we're at the South Pole. He was on his bike. So Keith was also cycling.
He took a bike with him?
He cycled 50% of the way.
Oh, did he?
So
now, is that easier or more difficult?
In places, it's much easier. On the blue ice, we were doing about 3K an hour. He was probably doing 15.
Right.
So he was incredible. But in other areas, I must admit, I admire Keith enormously for the fitness and the perseverance of sometimes pulling that bike with a sled attached.
Yeah.
Through big, deep snow, through sastrugi, through everything. So, you know, he was a superstar. And I think anyone that's interested in cycling, look up Keith Tuffley, because what he achieved was incredible.
And
so we had a race at the South Pole.
Yeah.
And he cycled and I ran.
Regular bike, by the way, or
it was a big fat bike. So you know the ones with the big fat wheels.
Okay, right.
One of those.
Of a mountain bike kind
yes,
of.
Yeah. It is,
okay,
yeah.
Right. So you had a race with him on the bike, and you.
And I beat him.
Oh, did you?
It was only because there was really deep snow there, but yeah. So we had good fun, but it's probably the most tiring thing we did for the 7 weeks.
So what was the first thing you did when you realized you'd made it to the South Pole? You'd done it.
Yeah, we just all had a big group hug. It was an emotional moment. So for all of us, Eric's been there before, but for Keith and I, it was, you know, an incredible achievement. And, you know, for me particularly, I think it was, I'm an ordinary guy and I've managed to complete something that's classed as extraordinary.
It is.
And, you know, it was hard. It was really difficult. So it's probably the most difficult thing I have done or ever will do. But I did it. So I think that's what I screamed out. You know, I did it. Yeah.
Scream it out to the universe.
Yeah, to Keith and Eric. But
yeah.
It was emotional as well for, you know, I did it for Cancer Research UK. I did it for my friend Neil. And I did it for my mum. And, you know, as I said, I've said before to you, you know, we've discussed cancer and it affects every family. And I think probably every one of your listeners has had some experience, within their extended families. And, you know, just trying to raise money to stop this is incredible. You know, we're talking about Trump. It really annoys me that they're going to spend 14 billion or whatever it is on a wall that would cure cancer. And, I just think we need to put life into perspective a bit more.
So now you're back.
Yes.
We've got an important day on Saturday, which I want to talk about in just a minute. When you first got back, what was it you realized that you'd missed the most when you were away?
Well, definitely my daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my family.
How old's your daughter?
She's going to be 12 in May. So wow. She's just started big school.
Yeah.
She was really proud of me, but it was just so lovely to get back to her. So, yeah, I've promised that I won't do such a long trip again.
But you will do something again.
Yes, I will.
You've got the bug now.
I have, yes, yes.
So you are now the explorer.
Well, yes.
And you'll be in a team with a new rookie.
I think two things now categorizes me as an explorer, so that's great.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So the two things are the North Pole
and the South Pole.
Yeah, you don't get much better than that. Yeah.
I think the next challenge is there's the seven peaks the seven highest peaks of each continent.
Right.
Which will be a real challenge, but it's something that I'd love to do.
You fancy a crack at that?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you've been raising money for Cancer Research UK.
Yes.
Your target was?
£50,000.
Where are you at right now?
So I've just made, I think I'm up to 15,000.
Okay.
So there's still a way to go.
Yeah.
That's why I'm just going to keep on.
But somebody listening to this might be inspired by your story. I might just give you a couple of bob.
Well, that would be hugely appreciated.
What do they have to do?
So my website is www.trek2poles. So it's T-R-E-K, the number 2. P-O-L-E-S .com.
And I found if you put Rob Smith South Pole, you
can
Google,
find it. Yes.
It just comes
and in fact,
up.
If you put Rob Smith South Pole or Antarctic in Google, it comes up with the link to the Just Giving site.
Right.
So if they go on the website, then look at the fundraising tab across the top and then click on the Just Giving icon.
Rob Smith, it's been a pleasure to meet you. I hope you'll stay in touch. And when
Definitely.
You do is it the seven peaks?
Seven peaks, yes.
I hope you'll let us know, and I hope we can talk to you from all seven peaks via satellite phone.
Brilliant.
Fantastic. Rob, let me shake your hand. I like shaking hands with a genuine hero, someone who's made a difference. And thank you for doing that and for raising awareness of this very, very important cause. All the best, and thanks once again for coming in. It really is an honor to meet you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it from London Calling for this week. Back next week, and in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm @GrahamMack. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. If you put your phone number in the email or your Skype details, I might get you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time, ta-da!